104.3 in Corvallis and 91.9 in Hood River, and via the World Wide Web is KBOO.FM. My name is Cecil Prescott, and I'll be joined by my co-host Celeste Carey, and this is More Talk Radio. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and you may also reach us by email at moretalkradio@gmail.com. Joining us this morning are three women who will talk to us about an innovative program that is here in Portland titled Healing Hurt People Portland. It is a fairly new program here in Portland that they'll share with us about its importance and their work. Joining us this morning are, I was going to say, but you can't see me, so you don't know who's on my left or my right. But on my left, just imagine this in your eye, is Dr. Alicia Moreland Kapuya, also Dr. Maggie Bennington Davis, and Cheryl Johnson. Thank you for joining us this morning.
It's great to be here.
Bennington Davis, I thought we might begin with you by just telling us about the program. What is Healing Hurt People Portland?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. This is a program that is that one becomes passionate about. So it's always a pleasure and an honor to be able to talk about it. And I'm actually not going to talk too long because the other two women in the room here know a lot more about the nuts and bolts of the program, but I'll give you just a minute of the history of the program. And this program, Healing Hurt People, came about when, thank you, adjusting my microphone there. This program came about when my boss, Dr. Daryl Walker at Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare, and I went back to Philadelphia to visit with some friends there who had put together a very interesting program at Drexel University called Healing Hurt People. And it's part of a spectrum or a system of programs across the country that I think Dr. Moreland Kapuya will tell you a little bit more about. But the essence of the program is that the understanding that people who come into services in healthcare often have had something pretty terrible happened to them. And as a result, they're finding their lives lived in violence and retaliation and reactivity. And that instead of diagnosing them with a mental health condition or a substance abuse condition or something along those lines, to really understand at a very deep level that something has happened in their lives that has continued to shape how they think and view the lives, and furthermore, how we react to them, particularly in this case, in hospitals and emergency rooms. So the essence of Healing Hurt People is that when people are injured through interpersonal violence, to understand the role of that violence in their ongoing lives and relationships and the way they view the world, and to try to intervene with education and support in helping them get to safety. So Dr. Walker and I came back to Portland very excited about how this program might fit in Portland with Cascadia, and Care Oregon helped us with a small grant to get us jump-started, and we went into partnership with Legacy Emanuel Hospital, and the program is now off and running, and we're pretty excited about that. And I bet Alicia can fill in a lot of the gaps in my story.
No gaps at all, just continuity. Yeah, the program has now been up and running for 7 months, and Cheryl Johnson will talk a little bit more about that because she's involved with sort of the day-to-day. But just in terms of the program, Healing Hurt People serves young males of color between the ages of 10 and 25. It's still mainly 10 and 25. We're looking to increase the age at some point, but for now it's 10 to 25, who have either been stabbed or shot. And they find themselves in the emergency department at Legacy Emanuel Hospital. Typically what had been happening before is these young men would end up in the emergency department, they get treated, and then they were released. And what would happen after that is about six weeks or so odd later, they show back up in the emergency department, and sometimes with two or three more other folks who had also been injured. And so what you saw is sort of this vicious cycle of folks being injured and re-injured. And while hospitals were doing an exceptional job of patching people up physically, there's sort of this long-term emotional or psychological component that wasn't being addressed. And in order to sort of get to a place of complete healing, I think most people recognize that it has to be done not just on a physical level, but on an emotional, on a psychological, and even in some ways on a spiritual level. So what Healing Hurt People seeks to do is to take all of those elements together and work with both injured young victims, systems, and family, and the family as a system, to help them heal and move toward a place of higher healing. We have been fortunate to be able to develop a wonderful relationship with a team over at Legacy Emmanuel, and what the team looks like. So Cascadia has already been in the business of what we call trauma-informed care and working in multidisciplinary teams, and that's led by with the strong leadership of Dr. Maggie Bennington Davis, and I hope she'll talk a little bit about more about what trauma-informed care is. But we were able to partner Cascadia with Legacy and their entire team, so the social workers, the chaplains, the trauma nurses, the front desk workers. And so everyone there is aware of what we wanted to accomplish with this Healing Hurt People program. And so one of the unintended, sort of intended consequences is not only we're helping to sort of heal families, and we'll talk a little bit about what services and things are provided and what the model looks like, but one of the unintended, intended consequences is that systems were being healed, and everyone's sort of speaking a different language, but the same language around how we approach people who have been, especially young males of color who have been injured, and how we treat them respectfully, how we treat them with dignity, with respect, and really work with their families to help them change the language that they use around the process of healing. So instead of talking about retaliation, now we're talking about what we can do to get better and to heal as a community and as a family from this injury. And that, using that as a means of helping prevent further injury. And we've had some major successes in that area, and we're really happy about it. It's a very different approach. It's a unique approach. And what we're excited about is two things. It's the point of intervention, which is at the hospital, which no other violence prevention program in the city of Portland is able to do. And it's the timing. So we get you in while you're in your most vulnerable sort of state. And there's sort of what we call this golden moment, where you're able to seize the opportunity to take advantage of people really first respecting that they are in a very vulnerable spot, and using that to really engage them in a way that is respectful, that's compassionate, but also gets them to think about doing something different. And then we're also engaging the families. And after that, we're working with them while they're in the hospital, and then we spend 6 months to a year after helping them explore different alternatives, whether that's housing, schooling, counseling, whether that's individual or family. And it allows them some time to just sort of get back on track and to focus on what they can do long term. And we have lots of community partners that we work with to do this. We're not doing it alone. Our goal was not to duplicate effort, but to really take advantage of the best of what Portland had to offer, and to offer sort of our additional expertise, which we have in clinicians and trained staff around this issue of trauma-informed care. So that is sort of, there's so much I think we can say because we're really excited about it, and there's a lot of things. We spent a lot of time. We launched June 7th of last year. We've been in operation, and we now are working with 10 clients. All of our referrals come from Legacy Emmanuel, but there is definitely a goal to sort of expand, because as you know, we have two level one trauma centers, but we're going to expand smartly and competently. And we are enjoying our relationship right now with Legacy Emmanuel, which has been a wonderful partnership thus far.
One of the things that I want to do is just commend the whole shift, the paradigm shift, that looks at trauma and violence from a health perspective. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of two other programs, and I don't know if you are working with them or they're coming from the same mindset, and one of them is a youth-focused program to stop youth violence. It's called Strive. It goes through Multnomah County.
Yes, we work with Rebecca. We work with Rebecca Staff.
We're partnering for another project as well. And then there's an effort that came through the Multnomah County District Attorney's off efforts.
The Blackmail Achievement?
Well, it's with Eric Zimmerman. Are you familiar with him?
Well, what's the name of the program?
Deputy you know, the moment you asked me,
I know.
It flew away, and so it'll come back. But it focuses on a combination of faith-based and comprehensive service
1145?
Model. Well, it works with 1145,
okay.
But it's not exclusively them.
Okay, because I can name, Ms. Celeste, I can name everybody, because we've brought everybody to the table. Our goal was
not to miss any thread in the tapestry.
Exactly.
I got you.
And so we're all working together for what we deem as collective impact.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that really thrills me, because many years ago I worked in nursing, and I had a chance to work in a mental health hospital. And one of the things you saw is that it was a piecemeal and symptom-focused effort. It was not focused on anything significant. So when I hear you say this, I get excited, because people are recognizing there's that health component, the emotional component, and then I hear you also saying you look at other things. And so for people who are not listening, or rather, let me phrase that, who are just now listening and have not had a chance to kind of catch up with it, that doesn't mean that you ignore any of the legal ramifications. What it means is that you work with folks and recognize that behaviors that cause people to get arrested many times have a health or an emotional cause.
Exactly.
And that's the root right there. And so by addressing that, then it reduces community violence. And you know what's really funny is a lot of indigenous cultures will love their people back into sanity, so to speak. And so I see this as like the modern resurgence of that. I'm so thrilled.
I love that.
No, you've just defined trauma-informed care for us.
Yes,
exactly what that's about. Yeah.
Let's hear from Cheryl Johnson. Now, you're the program manager.
I am.
And how did you get involved, and what are some of the things that excite you about the program?
Well, I'm really excited about the quality relationships that we're able to build with our clients. Myself, along with my colleague Joshua Lathan, who is the peer intervention specialist, we meet the clients right at the emergency room. When Dr. Moreland talked about that golden moment, that's our first encounter with them. And basically, it's some of the things that our sister just described about loving them back to health. I mean, we're there to meet needs. First of all, we want to keep them safe. So what we do when we're there in the earliest moments is really to help them to develop a safety plan, because oftentimes they are aware of who injured them. If it's a result of a shooting or sometimes a stabbing, they are aware who did this. And we really want to interrupt that cycle of violence and to prevent retaliation.
Well, let me ask you just in terms of process. So someone comes into the emergency room with a stabbed wound.
Right. What happens is we get a phone call. And our goal is to arrive to the emergency room within 30 minutes of that call. And oftentimes we're not able to actually meet with the patient. Maybe they're intubated or maybe they're headed to surgery. And in those cases, we try to find out who are the family members and interact with them, all of the significant others. So we're basically explaining to them what the program is, and just finding out who has influence and what are the details behind the incident. We really love it when we get the call from the social worker who has done a lot of the preliminary work and finding out the details. So it's really a warm transfer. And basically going in and establishing who we are and what our program is about and what we can do for them. So basically it really starts at that golden moment, that golden opportunity.
And I'm sorry, and just to sort of piggyback on Cheryl's, the beautiful thing about it is that the social worker and the chaplains have already done a lovely job of identifying who would meet the criteria for the program. And they've already explained to them preliminarily that we have a resource for you that we'd like to offer. And so by the time we get there, folks are already sort of receptive to sort of, you know, receive us and some of our help and services. And when Cheryl and Josh get there, they basically do a great job of engaging the family and the young victim of violence, and then figuring out what ways they can be helpful to them, not just in the moment, but while they are there, because average length of stay is about 3 to 5 days in the hospital. So figuring out how I can be useful to you while you're here, and then helping you transition out of the hospital in terms of the discharge planning in a way that's safe, in a way that's going to be beneficial to your sort of optimal healing, which I think is also another thing that we can't ignore in this process.
Right.
And safety plans are are done and needs assessments are also mm-hmm. done. So right. we're being very mindful of what people are needing. And Ms. Cheryl has mentioned reduction in retaliation and re-injury and changing the language up front. Mm-hmm. What we also end up seeing that ends up being a consequence of this program is we're reducing healthcare cost over time because people aren't returning back to the emergency department. We can give you some stats today. The 10 people in our program have not been re-injured, which means they have not re-entered another emergency department, which means that we've saved the state of Oregon some money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it happens to fall in line with these sort of coordinated care organizations and the goals of coordinated care organizations, and lucky us and lucky Oregon.
So I'm going to ask a hard question here.
Yeah. Maggie will
answer. And maybe you're not yet collecting data on this because the program is so new. But in terms of that circle of influence, mm-hmm. Have they gone out and re-injured anybody else?
That's not our understanding at all, mm-mm. that has not happened.
Okay. Not at all. Yep.
Okay. So in other words, we're feeling a positive ripple effect.
Right.
And okay. can you tell them why, Ms. Cheryl? Because the work, Josh is not here, unfortunately, mm-hmm. but he's our peer intervention specialist. He is key. Mm-hmm. And what we find, this is not new stuff, Celeste, and you know this, right? Mm-hmm. Relationship building and rapport building is right. key, but people talk about it, but they don't do it very well. Mm-hmm. So Josh does an excellent job of developing relationships with these young men and just being present and mm-hmm. popping up, hey, right. I'm just letting you know I'm looking at you. You know, these types of things, you know, just showing up actually has made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. And Cheryl and Josh both understand fully that this is not the first violent moment in these young men's lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, part of what they're bringing to the table is the understanding that this probably, this cycle that they're in, started a long time ago, mm-hmm. and the things that they've seen and endured and experienced during their childhoods are those things are now coming together in such a way that has all led to this moment. And so Cheryl and Josh understand mm-hmm. that they're looking at a moment in time in a big system, and so they're trying to intervene in this in the overall picture, not just patching them up in that little slice of time.
So some real paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let me remind you that you're listening to KBOO-FM. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Cheryl Johnson, Maggie Bennington-Davis, and Alicia Moreland-Kapuya of Healing Hurt People Portland. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, and you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. I want to go back a little bit more because this sounds like such an exciting program, and I think in the beginning you mentioned doing some research about other programs in other parts of the country and how you glean from them. Tell us a little bit about what you learned from other programs that are similar, mm-hmm. and were there things you had to change or alter because of Portland culture?
That's you.
Do you want to start? Okay.
No, that's
okay. So we, this is an interesting question. So we work very closely in the development of this program with Philadelphia's Healing Hurt People program. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you go to our website, on Cascadia's website, and I do just want to make this clear that Healing Hurt People Portland is a Cascadia Behavioral Health, Inc. program, because I think that sometimes gets lost. I mean, we've branded it with a new label and stuff, but it's a Cascadia program out of Cascadia. And so one of the things that was very important as we were developing it is to get some really good direction. And you're absolutely right. The demographics in Philadelphia are absolutely different from the demographics in Portland, but the challenges are sort of the same, right? They have different types of violence. But Dr. Ted Corbin, who is an emergency room physician, and Dr. John Rich, who is an internal medicine physician back in Philadelphia at Drexel, along with Dr. Sandra Bloom, who is a psychiatrist back in at Drexel, and they also work at the School of Public Health, they sort of run the Healing Hurt People Philadelphia program that's under the Department for Nonviolence and Social Justice. So it's a large sort of departments, and they have lots of different, and Healing Hurt People Philadelphia falls under the umbrella. Anyway, a lot of the work was inspired by a lot of the things that they've been able to do back in Philadelphia, and they've been able to powerfully demonstrate some of the outcomes that we're looking for. So they've been able to see that when you employ this particular model, you can reduce retaliation, reentry rates, rearrest, and save healthcare costs. And they work with me monthly to talk to me about it. Now, there are 22 other programs like the Healing Hurt People type structure across the country. Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston, Baltimore. Maryland, Baltimore, Oakland, which I spent some time down in Oakland, California, to see their program and the model. And we have similar structure, but I think what's different, what you'll follow, we have three stages in the program. We have this golden moment, which we've talked about. We've talked about the in-hospital engagement piece a little bit. But what we haven't really talked about is that post-discharge phase, if we were talking about it in phases. And our post-discharge looks a little different. Not vastly different, but a little different because of the fact that we offer what are called self-groups. And these self-groups are trauma-informed, psycho-educationally based groups that look at, SELF is an acronym for safety, emotions, loss, and future, and it's a trauma-informed curriculum, an evidence-based trauma-informed curriculum that was developed by Dr. Sandra Bloom, and it helps families and injured victims go through and to sort of process their loss and trauma, and even as it relates to oppression and things like that in a very powerful way. We also offer individual counseling and family counseling, which is a little different. But all the other wraparound services are similar to other programs, but we've been able to get direction from these other programs based on, or shape our program based on what these other programs have been able to successfully do. And they've been able to collect a lot of data. We are a part of the national database. It's a national network of hospital-based violence intervention programs, which is a research entity. We're a part of it. And so we enter our data every month into a database called QuestGen. Mm-hmm. And we're looking to contribute to a larger body of literature and publish some work within the next year. We've got to continue to collect data. But all of the programs across the country as a part of this national network of hospital-based violence intervention programs have been able to collect data and to produce reports. And we're looking to do the same. So we have several levels of accountability, not just our own internal goals, but sort of the national goals, which is a huge standard to live up to, but we plan to do it and are well on our way. And then, of course, our sort of the internal goals of, you know, within Cascadia. So
given all of that type of, let's see, how do I want to call it, exponential outreach and multi-level and multi-dimensional outreach, are you finding an additional focus coming out of government support such as the Center for Disease Control? Because I know the whole idea of violence as public health issue has been one of their focuses and has been rising in the past few years. Are you getting support for that so that you have some longevity for this programming and funding?
Okay, so they're looking at me again. So we're working. so we are working towards that. As Dr. Bennington Davis shared, we got our first seed money from CARE Oregon, which, thank you, CARE Oregon, and we have stretched that money. We have worked it to the max. We've made it work to its best. and we have been able to sort of, as you know, when you're starting a program, people want to know, well, what are you doing before we sort of invest? Like, what can it look like? And I think that we have some compelling evidence now to sort of prove that we are making tremendous progress. We had an opportunity last year in November, well, this past November, to present to Governor Kitzhaber and the Oregon Educational Investment Board and let them know sort of what we're doing. And there was an OPB story actually about it where the governor actually spoke about the program and said, well, if we employ this program, we can actually save untold millions, end quote, was sort of his word. And not mine, those were the governor's words. and so we are definitely on the radar, and people are thinking about ways that they can continue to sort of support our program and our effort, and we are in the process of sort of applying for funding, for some additional funding, but we also have a longer-term sustainability model that we are looking at sort of around having licensed individuals providing services and being able to bill for those services. So there's sort of, it'll be a mix of things that'll need to happen, but we have had individual donors give money. Thank you to those folks who have done it, have gone to the Cascadia website and just given based on what they've heard. And we welcome that because we are doing wonderful work, and a good portion of those funds are going directly to the clients and for client services.
Yeah, that's great.
Our largest challenge is around housing, which I know a lot of people have challenges with, but finding housing for folks to get them into a different environment in a safer place after the injury. So if anybody out there has thoughts or ways that they'd like to problem solve that with us, we have some thoughts. We welcome that.
I have some thoughts. We'll talk about it offline. Okay, let me get out without telling
okay,
you.
Okay, wonderful.
I do love that you know about the CDC study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences mm-hmm. study, and how that relates to health and healthcare expense. And so forth. So that's really cool. And, you know, that wasn't, you know, 10 years ago, even though the study existed, not very many people were talking about
yes.
it. Now more and more and more people are aware that what happens during childhood, that adversity in childhood, actually has ramifications in people's health mm-hmm. and well-being and in our overall healthcare expenditures and really the health of our nation, the
yes.
social health as well as the physical health. So I'm just so impressed that you brought that up. Thank you.
Well, I saw the connection, and that's one of my specialties, I guess I'll mm-hmm. call it. But we want to also take advantage of connecting to our listeners. So if you've got questions about how you can either access or support the program, if you have questions about how the program runs, give us a call, 503-231-8187, here on More Talk Radio.
Or email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. One listener asked, how does domestic violence relate to America's war culture? And can we really stop violence at the local level before addressing our imperialism?
Wow.
Well, you know, I think one way to look at this might be if we kind of dissect it, we're focusing on young men of color. So even though we might be westernized and then Americanized, there are certain, I guess we'll call it ethnic and social connections that make a difference. And maybe if we speak to that, because what that does is that kind of peels off some of the layers, I think. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's this larger philosophical question that, mm-hmm. that I think this listener is asking.
Addressing, right.
And I appreciate it. I have a healthy appreciation for the sort of what may seem like the contradictions mm-hmm. that we live in, but that's sort of the world we live in. We all live in dichotomous states where you can be completely striving in one area of your life and failing in the other, but still moving. And I think what the heart of the question is, how can you tackle violence at the small level when there are wars going on?
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate the question. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, as my grandma used to say, it's very cliche, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. And I think that this is a first step. It's not going to resolve every single issue, but it's definitely resolving a salient issue within this community. And I think if you can start and provide some examples of programs and interventions that are effective around, then maybe we can start, you know, applying that to sort of larger issues. And that may not speak to the depth of the larger philosophical sort of ethical issues around war and violence and a violent culture. But I think the way you begin to shift culture yeah. is you got to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it may be small or seem small.
So let me expand that a little bit more, because maybe we cannot address, you know, American imperialist culture. But certainly in our communities, violence is something that is a part of life. And so I'm wondering, when you have one individual who comes in and is a part of your program, as you suggested, that person lives in a larger community where violence seems to be a remedy or the best remedy to address problems. How do you work with people to seek other ways of addressing problems that will not lead them
conflict management. Yeah,
we have a variety of services offered through Cascadia. One of the things that helps a lot is really the strength of the relationships that we develop with them. And because we're able to offer behavioral health assessments as a part of our program too, it deals with that person one-on-one to help them think about their past, think about their choices and what brings them to the current situation where they are, and helping them to connect the dots. I mean, this doesn't happen overnight, but the fact that they're engaging with us is one of those mm-hmm. important steps. Mm-hmm. And being able to recognize.
A huge part of it is education. Mm-hmm. And I would say that to your listener's comment as well, as, you know, your listener has, it's a pretty sophisticated question, and it falls in the category of parallel process. Mm-hmm. And parallel process goes both ways. So yes, the violent world that we live in certainly has a trickle-down effect to our individual lives, but the reverse is true too, as Alicia pointed out, mm-hmm. that you know, it starts with a single step. And the same thing with the people that are being served in Healing Hurt People. It starts with education about how this exposure to trauma and violence, particularly in early childhood, actually has an impact on how you think, on how your brain works, on how you see the world. And if you can start to understand that, then that's the first step to being able to see the world differently and understand that what we wind up doing is perpetuating this violence, particularly for our children and our children's children. Mm-hmm. And that education really can make a huge, humans are amazing in their resilience. Mm-hmm. And if they have the thorough understanding, the model of, you know, why they think the way they think or why they see the way they see, that can often be the change point.
And let me just offer and piggyback on that. I think giving people the opportunity to see something in a different way.
See something different.
Because oftentimes they're not even given, I can't explain Mount Adams to you if I've never seen it. I can't mm-hmm. describe it. But if I'm giving you an opportunity and exposing you to a different way, I'm expanding your options and your capacity. I'm expanding your capacity to do something different. And that's really kind of what we're saying. And we don't force, and we can go into all of these different treatment modalities that we do, but I don't want to bore the listeners to death, but there are different models that we actually employ, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical mm-hmm. behavioral therapy, that allows people to explore themselves. So we throw everything on a whiteboard and we say, okay, let's explore it. I'm going to hold your hand. We're going to explore it together. Mm-hmm. And let's figure out, you tell me where you see the contradictions are or where the challenges have been. And does it make sense to keep going down the same path and you're getting these results, but you're telling me you want something different?
Right.
So let's reconcile the two. It's a very interesting approach, and I think that's what makes it exciting. And I know that we have some callers, so I will be quiet.
All right. Good morning, LJ.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine.
Okay, great. Thank you for this dialogue. As you folks are probably aware, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, was here recently investigating the use of excessive force by the Portland Police Bureau of people who are suffering with mental issues. Mm-hmm. Vis-a-vis Aaron Campbell, James Chassie, and Keating Otis. And the Portland Police Bureau's use of excessive force and violence against people of color and people who have mental issues. And I'm just wondering if you guys are working with the Portland Police Bureau in order to try and reduce the levels of violence against this population. And I certainly will take my answers off the air, and thank you very much for the show.
Thank you for the question, LJ. And I will say, as we launch into it, one of the responses for the Department of Justice study was the police to institute the Behavioral Crisis Unit. And so are you working with them? I think it's one of the things that our caller mm-hmm. was asking.
Right. I actually sit on the Behavioral Health Unit Advisory mm-hmm. Board, and so do a lot of other people who are equally steeped in trauma-informed care and concerned, as our caller is, about this. And what I've seen so far is a greatly enhanced training for a specialized unit of the police. So it's a volunteer for part of the police force who volunteer to get extra training about people with mental illness, about people in behavioral crisis. And so the Behavioral Health Unit Advisory Committee has been able to have a voice in what is getting trained. And everything that we've talked about this morning, the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experience study, trauma-informed care, the impact of trauma and violence, both on the police as well as on the people that they're interacting with, have all become a part of the enhanced curriculum. And so far, only one cohort bunch of police officers have been through this enhanced training. But it's a very intensive week-long training, and a big, big part of it has to do with trauma-informed care and exactly what the caller is calling in about. So he's right on.
Yes. Let's see. It is 8:38. This is your opportunity if you've got questions, or especially if you're seeking assistance for a family or friend. Give us a call, 503-231-8187. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city.
I don't think we've mentioned in passing the website, but how would people contact you,
yes,
Cheryl?
By contacting us on the website, I think Dr. Moley mentioned earlier on the Cascadia, we have a link for healing hurt people.
www.cascadiabhc.org. And you can just, if for those who just want to do it the quick way, go to Google, type in Cascadia Behavioral Health, Inc., Portland. Mm-hmm. And you can also type in Healing Hurt People, Portland, and it'll pop up on Cascadia's website. It'll direct you. You can get a really full explanation of how the program runs and our philosophy, the model, and you'll also see a list of our advisory council members if you click on there and who we're sort of connected with. And as you can see, our advisory council, if you go on and peruse the website, you'll see that we have a number of people from the city, from the county, through the STRIVE organization, DCJ. So we've done a pretty thorough job of trying to make sure that we got our bases covered.
And if you're low-tech, the phone number is 503-402-8111. There you go. I wanted to add something because I had mentioned it, and we strayed just a little way as we're waiting for our next brave souls to just call and get engaged here. When I mentioned earlier about with regard to the larger philosophy of how do you have peace at home when you've got war in the world, and I was speaking in terms of ethnic answers, I want to go back and point out a couple of examples, and one of them you'll find in a lot of the Alaskan Eskimo cultures is where they sent young men out so they can have some solitary introspective moments, and then they come back and they kind of love them into place. And for a lot of us, especially that have become westernized, we don't have always those cultural and those ethnic opportunities to kind of reconnect with each other. We've lost it because we're chasing industrialization, you know, and we kind of forgotten that. Do you take advantage of a larger familial structure and the cultural roots to give a person some grounding and strength as part of this whole care? And if so, how do you? So mm-hmm. people who are listening might see, yes, you can have a small victory in the light of this larger piece of chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we were very intentional in the people that were hired to implement this program. And as we alluded to before, Joshua Latham, our peer intervention specialist that spends time implementing the program and implementing the services, you know, he's a person that's had lots of experience with working with young men in this age group, and mm-hmm. he looks like them. Okay. And that makes a really big difference. And he's had lived experience. And it all goes back down to that relationship. So he has a deep connection and understanding, you know, I've been there too. I understand what you're feeling. And it really makes a difference. And in fact, it seems like some of the young men, the relationship is so strong, it almost feels like extended family.
Mm. And so what Michelle is speaking to is this peer model. And as you know, mm-hmm. there's been a large peer movement in Oregon, and this peer movement was really headed by another Cascadia member,
Megan Cahay,
who actually pushed for legislation that would allow people to get the experience and the training, and they're working with Portland State, so you can get certified to provide peer services, and then you're employable, so you can go and provide these services and be useful to an organization by doing so. And so we employ the same model. It's shown, it's proven to be effective, it's proven to be helpful. And in terms of culture, I think that that word culture is so interesting, because culture is so
multifaceted.
Absolutely. And so there's a culture, there's a subculture, there's a subculture within a subculture. So I think that it's, we try to make sure that we understand the context in which each of these individuals are living in. So even though they're males of color, they're not the same.
Not the same, not from the same culture.
Absolutely. And so that's a part of our assessment at the beginning, and making sure that we've gotten that right, so that we can, again, help to do the most good for that particular client within that particular moment, under those particular circumstances. And so I think that
point of convergence.
Absolutely. And that's the point at which Josh and Cheryl are at the height of their effectiveness.
It's also been helpful having people that are from the neighborhood, that live in the community, that are familiar with the roads and the places that these young people travel.
Yeah.
Great.
And we have another caller. Chong, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's crazy to be on the radio.
Hey, well, yeah, take a deep breath and just talk to us.
My question is there been an attempt to there's so many programs and so many great programs that are doing similar work and doing similar things. Is there an attempt to kind of collaborate with one another? For example, if the recipient that you're working with needs something, then you have kind of like a quick place to go to, hey, you can go here, or these options. Has there been like an attempt for collaboration among different nonprofits and different organizations that serve similar clients in that way?
That's a great question. We did not set out to duplicate the services. We work with a variety of people. There's just all kinds of community members that are either on our advisory board or people that we have access to, whether it be in education or housing. We're working to develop those relationships. And we have some innovative partners that are doing some pretty innovative things as well. You know, we have a person that provides fly fishing, you know, whether it's social activities, educational background, law enforcement needing some help with legal services and legal fees, you know, we have those partners, and so those are services that are available to us.
So in short, to your answer,
yes.
Yes, we do. And again, that really was the goal, is to make sure that, again, figuring out who does what really well, and then working with them to basically be a resource, for us to be a resource to them and for them to be a resource to us. And again, the goal, and I'm using this term because it's very important in this direction we should all be moving in, is collective impact. We there are certain things we know we're not going to be able to do super well, but that's why we've built the strong relationships, just to make sure that we are serving our clients the best we can.
The tricky part, Chom, is that often people with this history of exposure to trauma and violence are pretty wary of what the system has to offer them. They're pretty wary of these programs. And Alicia has alluded to many times during this conversation the golden moment. And that was the piece that was missing, we felt like, in the spectrum of services, where people are able to be engaged during this moment of vulnerability in the emergency department. When they've been injured, there's something about that little window of time that allows them to be connectable in a way that they're not normally. Mm-hmm. So that's how our program fits in and tries to take advantage of that golden moment to really engage people in order to get them to all those other services that Cheryl and Alicia and you are thinking about.
So that seems like, Cheryl, what you mentioned before, it's so important that when you get that call that you're there as fast as possible to be able to interact with the injured person and his family.
And when we're talking about cultural appropriateness, being able to interact with the family, being able to be that voice and to be that person that's not necessarily medical staff, but someone feels comfortable talking to and talking to in a way that they wouldn't interact with medical staff.
I know that the city also has a program. It's a crisis intervention team. And are you familiar with them? Do you also have contacts with them? So, because a lot of times they're the first ones on the scene.
So, yeah, you're talking about Officer Marcy Jackson.
Yes, I am.
And she's on our advisory council.
All right, all right.
And she also represents 1145. Uh-huh. And yes, we are very, and actually, I'm glad you asked that question because she is aware of the services and the things that we can provide as a part of Healing Hurt People, and many times will shy away from, well, not shy away, but she will call and make sure that Healing Hurt People has been called because mm-hmm. she understands the impact that the program can have. And so that's the, I think that demonstrates the beauty of the connectedness and the beauty of the commitment mm-hmm. that the community has to make sure that we're doing the best by the young people we're working hard to
and
serve.
And working, realizing that sometimes it's parallel courses.
Right, and
that
it doesn't feel competitive at all.
Right.
What it feels like is partnership.
Right.
So.
And in some cases, she has been the person that has done that warm transfer
to Healing Hurt People.
Okay.
So, yeah, she's, and she is the crisis response team for
right.
them.
Right, yes, she is.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Alicia Morland Kapuya, Dr. Maggie Bennington Davis, and Cheryl Johnson of Healing Hurt People Portland. Our numbers are 503-231-8187 and moretalkradio@gmail.com. I believe we have another caller. No, we don't.
Okay.
So we'll continue on. I was wondering, because this is such a new program and you are the new kids on the block, are there things you are learning? Are there resistance to your program? Are you feeling the need to win the trust of more established agencies or individuals?
Or are they welcoming you because they recognize that, well, many mm-hmm. hands may like the work?
The latter.
Okay, good.
The latter. It has mm-hmm. been, I have not felt, I think the beauty of it is me being sort of a little homegrown Portland girl. I came back and people were like, oh, come on, baby, honey, for whatever you need, you know. And so it's been really nice to sort of come back and for people to see, I think when people see your heart and they see that they're, and it's unadulterated and you're working to try to just do the best you can to be the best person you can to serve the community, and people actually see that genuinely, then there's no need for people. It's not when they see your heart, they can trust you.
Yes.
Right. And so there's no, there's nothing. Sort of what you see is what you get. There's no ulterior motives. It's we're here to help because we see a need, and people have been gracious and opened up their doors and joined us at our table, and we're grateful for that. And for those partnerships.
Well, Alicia, you've done a brilliant job putting mm-hmm. this program together, and those connections that you've had throughout your lifetime in Portland are really just so important and valuable to this program. So,
well, that's nice coming from Boss Lady. Thank you.
Well, if it's somebody who has had the opportunity to see it when she was much younger, you know, you could see the beginnings of a hub, a community hub uh-huh. here. As I remember as a young person, you know, creating a lot of strong connections and then just curious mm-hmm. and stepping outside of comfort zones to make those boundaries disappear and to welcome different ideas and thoughts and people. So you've got the perfect person.
Well, you know, you clearly know her well.
I want to really commend all of you for,
yes.
for this tremendous work that you're doing. So often in our society, young men of color are looked at as the other.
Mm-hmm.
As the enemy, people who mm-hmm. are afraid of. And I was certainly struck by the people you work with in terms of the age, 10 to 25.
Mm-hmm.
So you have really young kids mm-hmm. who are impacted by this violence. So thank you for doing that. Are there things that...
Before you move past mm-hmm. that thought, I just want to put a plug in for Dr. John Rich's book that he wrote a few years ago now. It's called Wrong Place, Wrong Time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's an internal medicine doc, and he was, I think he was in Boston when this happened to him. He noticed that young boys and men of color would come into the emergency room, and then he wouldn't see them anywhere else in the healthcare system, and he got curious mm-hmm. about what was going on there, and so he started his own little investigation. And what he discovered was that even in the emergency room when, and he himself is African American as well, and he noticed that when these kids really came into the emergency room, they were often treated as the perpetrator, not as mm-hmm. victims themselves, as if they had done something bad or wrong. And he started following them, literally following them, trying to understand how they got there and what happened to them subsequently. And what he found is they often got there as really, truly as victims, of, as mm-hmm. people who were literally in the wrong time, in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then the system really abandoned them and treated them as if they, you know, they were people who ought to be punished instead of treated or supported or healed. And so he wrote this stunning book called Wrong Place, Wrong Time, describing that phenomenon. And that very much informed the Healing Hurt People program at Drexel University in Philadelphia, which, of course, is our is our mentor. Yeah. And so now it informs us.
And Ms. Cheryl also, I think there's a piece that she can speak to, is that it doesn't just stop internally. They've done a lovely job. This education piece doesn't just stop at the level of the hospital, but Ms. Cheryl has and Josh have teamed up with
The trauma nurses Talking Tough, which is an organization, they
at
come out
legacy.
Of the legacy. Mm-hmm. What we've been doing is we've been going and delivering these messages to
the student bodies.
Yeah, alternative schools in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really great because it talks about the decisions that young people make, that age group that we deal with, the 10 to 25, and how the brain development. And so, you know, if we were really important to keep you safe, mm-hmm. during those developmental ages when you're not making the best decisions all the time.
Right.
So that leads to one question I think we have time for before we have to go. People returning and becoming an ambassador of the sort. When I hear you talking about young people, and given the fact that I've volunteered a lot with young people, I've worked with a lot of young people, and I think in terms of paradigm shifts, have you been able to get any of your former participants to be willing and able to go back to various communities and talk about that transitional moment?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, and we are, again, 7 months operating, and we generally have people in the program 6 months to a year.
Okay, so
we
so
haven't
still
completed,
new.
We haven't completed the mm-hmm. year cycle. However, the other 22 programs do that. Once they complete the program
Great.
And they're out, they actually offer them an opportunity to come back and be employed
mm-hmm.
And to as a peer mentor and a specialist, mm-hmm. and we tend to follow suit. So not only are we helping people heal, but we're creating, you know, creating jobs, right? Giving people
mm-hmm.
an opportunity to
giving people
back.
Job skills.
Job skills mm-hmm. and something that they are passionate about and can do well. So if we were betting people, we'd bet that they stay at that job because it gives them fulfillment. So we are looking to do that. We have a longer term plan, and hopefully you'll invite us back after after another year, and we'll have an
mm-hmm.
opportunity to give you some more interesting data. But we are super excited about the direction we're going in, and we appreciate the time, the effort, and we just we welcome any more inquiries in additional support. So
if the ordinary person wants to be supportive, maybe they don't have money, maybe they don't have expertise, but they've got time and heart, mm-hmm. what can they do?
Oh.
Well, we're always looking to plug people in.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you know,
mentors.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. based on the needs of our clients. Somebody has a skill and somebody has something that
yeah.
can be given and appreciated. So,
yeah.
so come to
Let
the
us
program.
Know what you do.
You know, now,
we'll
and then I will say, those who are listening, be aware that because you're dealing with vulnerable populations, that you may have to pass a vetting process.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, background checks, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But if your heart is willing and you're able and you don't have the other resources you want to contribute, give it a chance.
Please.
Give it a call.
Yes.
And what's the website?
www.cascadiabhc.org.
And again, for low-tech, contact 503-402-8111.
Now, it's not just low tech, you know, when
hey, it's low tech. Low tech is not bad.
Okay.
It just means you're not investing a whole bunch of mechanical infrastructure into it. That's
okay.
All. I like low tech. Conversation's low tech, but it's high energy and high return on investment.
Okay. Good comeback. Okay, we want to thank you all for joining us this morning. I'm Cheryl Johnson, Dr. Maggie Bennington Davis, and Dr. Alicia Moreland Kapuya of Healing Hurt People Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And thank you for your great work, and I'm hoping that people will contact you and take this in a good way. I hope that someday you'll go out of business.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to Your Peer Support Model, KBOO Portland, where what we do is because we're part of you. Support us in our upcoming membership drive. Keep us strong. Keep us connected to you and for you connected to us. 503-231-8032. Ask how you can become a member today.
Excellent, Celeste, as always.
Yeah. I've got a smattering of knowledge in wide places.
She's been doing this forever. Well, not forever.
I've been doing this show since about 92, 93.
Yeah.
And I was part of the AmeriCorps program.
Yeah, but I have a dream.
Oh, yeah, I have a dream. So that's how I met her.
Class one.
Yes,
so you probably know her son Michael.
KBOO's Winter Membership Drive is right around the corner starting on February 6th, and we need your help in raising $94,000. Can you show leadership by offering a matching gift of $500 or more? These generous matches have proven to be very successful in helping KBOO raise money. If you are interested, please call KBOO at 503-231-8032, extension 207, or email us at membership@kboo.org. Thanks, and I look forward to hearing from you soon.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. The time is 9 o'clock, and up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater. Featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 3rd Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll talk football, education and neoliberalism, minimum wage, teen fiction, and we'll hear the music of Pete Seeger. We opened this morning's show with Old Mole Bill Resnick talking with feminist writer and activist Soraya Shemily about football and the Super Bowl. Following yesterday's big game, Bill and Soraya take a critical look at football with an element of appreciation for the National Football League Players Association, who have tried to separate the game from the life. We will hear from well-read Red Fran Michelle, who discusses education in the age of neoliberalism. And in the second half of our program, Joe Clement talks with Jeff McDonald and Peter Oxform, both editors of Ruthless Criticism, an online journal of politics. In their recent article for Counterpunch, Who Needs the Minimum Wage, McDonald and Oxform contend that working for wages guarantees poverty and ask the question, if the discussion only focuses on the amount, this ignores what the minimum wage is and what its purpose is. What does this tell us about working for wages, and what kind of economy is this? We'll have book mole Larry Bolden review author Veronica Roth's 2011 novel Divergent, the first in a trilogy of young adult dystopian novels. Divergent has been compared to The Hunger Games, as well as Philip K. Dick's 1964 novel Clans of the Alfine Moon. And we'll conclude today's program with a short tribute to the late Pete Seeger by Bill Resnick. Pete Seeger died this past Monday, January 27th. We will play his music throughout the hour. We'll turn now to Bill and Soraya Shemily, who talk about football and the Super Bowl.
Thanks, Denise. Soraya Shemily, welcome to KABU.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
Soraya Shemily is a writer, blogger, critical feminist. Her work can be found on the Huffington Post and the website Women Under Siege, amongst many other places. If you want to find her, though, her last name begins with a C, Shemily, C-H-E-M-A-L-Y. Soraya, you've written on football. Yesterday was Super Bowl Sunday, when the best of the best go out there and try to kill one another. For the hundreds of millions, maybe actually billions this year, of people around the planet watching, the game gets competed with and sometimes even overshadowed by the corporate advertising and the military presence, as well as, of course, the dancing women. Soraya, you wrote that the most important question about football for parents and all of us is not so much the injuries, although they are severe and long-lasting, but what lessons kids are learning about how to define themselves and how to relate to one another. You answered that question. They were pretty terrible lessons. Did yesterday's game have anything that caused you to alter that opinion?
not really. I mean, yesterday's game, of course, is a high point of the year for many people. It's a lot of fun. It's part of our national imagination. And as you and I've discussed, there are lots of very positive aspects, obviously, to having communities and being fans and supporting your team. But the structure of the game itself, I think, tells a pretty difficult and destructive story. So no, I would have to say probably not.
What is your, give us a sense of your critique.